The meeting of the House Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. Members, we have a lot of bills we're going to try to get through here today, and we're probably going to end up with a session this evening. In fact, very, very likely we're going to have a session this evening, and that will be in Hearing Room 10 to complete our agenda. And we're going to change and switch up here. We've got Representative Hillstrom and her testifier, so we want to get to this bill. House File 3578, I'll move that. And we're sending that to civil law. So, Representative Hillstrom, you want to go ahead and tell us your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3578 is the governor's bill, and it really deals with the predatory offender registration changes. And there are only two provisions that are really relevant to this committee, and so I really want to stay narrowly focused. My testifier is here only to answer questions if you have any. Section 1 authorizes the use of driver's license photographs located on an individual that is required to be a predatory offender just so that they can access those photographs for identification and for location. Second is in Section 6. It allows the predatory registration folks to access expiration of license plate tabs, driver's license, or government identification cards, or watercraft licenses. That's it, Madam Chair. That's why it's here, so we can have access to the data that you keep. That's it.
Thank you, Representative. Who are the predatory offender folks? What did you say? I mean, who is going to have the permission to review this?
Madam Chair, it is the Department of Public Safety who keeps the predatory registration, and so those are the people who keep track of that information and access it through the BCA.
Roughly how many people does that amount to?
Madam Chair, Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm not going to try to guess for you how many registered offenders we have. We will get you that information.
All right, Ms. Engler, thank you. But I think what you're saying is it's a finite group of people.
Madam Chair, these are the folks that are mandated under the law to register as a predatory offender, and so it would only be after conviction by a court that they are required to register as a predatory offender.
All righty. Thank you very much. I think then we will go ahead. Was there a question? I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3578 to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll return to number one on our agenda, which is Representative Lucero, House File 3339. While you're coming up, Representative, I'll make a motion that House File 3339 come before the committee and be re-referred to Transportation Finance. Welcome, and please proceed, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill is in relation to weight restrictions. So presently, we have roads that obviously have weight restrictions, and those are the weight restrictions themselves are regulated. And there are certain exclusions for certain types of vehicles from those weight restrictions. What this bill seeks to do is to add to that list of vehicles a weight exclusion for septic vehicles that pump and transport sewage. And so I represent an area of the state that has a significant portion of it is septic tanks, and a good portion of Minnesota is obviously the homes are septic tanks. So this is an important bill, and I have several testifiers to give more information.
Okay, very good. Do you want to begin, sir, and give us your name and who you represent for the record?
Yes, my name is Pat Martin, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association. This is a critical issue for homeowners in the state. As you know, we have lots of trouble with some of the 400,000 septic systems in the state, and on occasion, we need to come to a homeowner's house in the dead of winter and pump a basement so that there's not live sewage in their basement. The problem for us oftentimes is that we have to go through a permitting procedure, which requires us to get permissions from the city and other regulatory authorities so that we can drive our pump trucks to the distressed house. Needless to say, everybody can imagine what the problems are with this particular septic system malfunction. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have lots of experts here. They have letters from individuals that they'd like to quickly note into the record, if that's all right with you.
Sure, that would be great. And those who want to testify, please decide the order you want to come up in.
Thank you.
If there are some letters, perhaps our page can receive the copies of those. So welcome to the committee, and please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Yeah, my name is Tristan Endy. I'm with Endy Septic Service. We're out of Rogers, Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 3339. First off, I'd like you to know that Minnesota is the only state that does not exempt septic trucks from seasonal weight restrictions. In our service area, we experience a high volume of septic systems and septic holding tanks that need to be pumped once they are full. During the springtime weight postings, we experience delays in getting to those businesses and residential tanks. And during winters, when there are frozen septic systems, the need for service increases threefold. When a resident who's on private septic system has an overfull tank, typically an alarm will sound inside their home, warning them that the tanks are overfull and they're in need of immediate attention. There's also systems that do not have alarms, and the only way they know they're having a problem is when it backs up and fills their basement with sewage. The need for timely service during this situation is imminent. The time delays for septic pumpers to have to make multiple stops in order to acquire an overweight permit by the city or county we work in makes this difficult during the seasonal weight restrictions. At times, we've had customers with sewage in their basements for an excess of a 24-hour period, and an even entire weekend before we can obtain the necessary permits needed to get onto the road to their property. So not only do these residents have to bear the heartache of damaged property caused by sewage backup, the cost for their pumping service increases because of the fees. The fees average from $50 to $500 per resident, depending on the city they live in. This is an unfair hardship on the residents in our state who are basically being punished for having a private septic system. It's time for Minnesota to get on board with the other states and exempt septic pumping trucks from weight postings during the springtime load weight restrictions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Endy. Any questions? Okay. Who's up next?
Hello.
Welcome. Please give us your name.
Josh Spudland. I'm the owner of Sewer Services. We're also another pumping company. Basically, the same situation he was speaking of. We have a lot of customers, especially this time of year when the road restrictions come on, that have frozen septic systems that basically, as soon as they fill their system back up, the drain field is frozen, so it can't receive any more water. So it's important that we're able to get back out there and service them on a regular basis. Sometimes it's as often as a week. I think another really important thing to note is that anytime sewage is exposed to people, whether it's backing up in a dwelling, leaking out on the ground, it is considered an imminent health threat. So government organizations like the MPCA require that we get out there and immediately handle these problems. So, you know, the safety aspect of it. So environmentally and as far as the health basis goes, it is important that we're able to service these. And some municipalities are easy to work with, some are almost impossible. So it really does hinder us being able to get out there and help these people. Plus, it adds a lot of costs if we have to buy permits or make multiple trips, that type of stuff. So.
Very good.
Great. Thank you,
Mr. Spudland. Welcome, sir. Give us your name and who you represent, please.
My name is Brian Koski. My company is Septic Check, and we're based out of Malacca in central Minnesota. I'm also a member and part of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association. Madam Chair and committee, thanks for allowing us to come speak today. I am here in support of the Bill 3339. Wastewater is generated from every home occupied in the state every single day of our of the year. About 25% or so homes in the state are served by on-site septic systems as their means of treatment and proper disposal of sewage. Septic systems are obviously, therefore, a pretty big component of the infrastructure in the state, and very important for every rural home, especially or homes that don't have the ability to connect to city sewer services. Maintenance and repair are critical to keep this infrastructure operating properly at all times of the year. Before I go any further, I'm going to describe in just a couple of brief sentences what a septic system is. It's basically when you flush a toilet or use water in the home, wastewater enters into a watertight septic tank. From there, the gray water gravity flows or is pumped into a drain field disposal system where the water eventually gets back down into the soil. And throughout that process, bacteria and other physical means of treatment happen to return the water back in the soil in a clean manner. The most challenging time of the year for septic contractors in general is usually in the winter when we have freezing problems with septic systems, or in the spring for a couple of reasons. When weight restrictions are on, there's obviously limitations. That's the reason why we're here, for accessing people's homes. When they have a holding tank, for example, they don't have a drain field, so when the tank is full, they need to be pumped and hauled away. That happens all year long. We also have the other issue when a septic system freezes. The homes basically are operating on a holding tank, so when the tank is full, it needs to be pumped and hauled away. And then the other component or challenge with the springtime or this period of time when road limits are on is we usually have a lot of melt, a lot of rains when the ground's saturated, and septic systems that have issues or are near a point where they're going to fail, usually that's the time when things actually, the scale tips and they have a major problem where they could have backups in the basement or the flush the toilet and ends up all over the floor. So when one of those three conditions exist, we essentially most of the time have to come out to the house and pump their tank, or worst case scenario, if something does end up backing up in their house, we have to pump out their basement. So the whole the challenge with not being able to do that or having limitations on that in the springtime obviously adds cost to the homeowner, can be environmental concerns with wastewater potentially in people's homes, or possibly spilling out onto the ground if their tanks are full and they don't notice it. The other one example that I wanted to share too is we do have a couple of businesses, apartment buildings, a convenience store that we have right now that our business is taking care of. We have to pump their tanks several times a week for them to stay open, and that's pretty much their only option to keep the doors open at this point. So it is vital that this bill be moved forward, that it creates the permanent allows us to permanently help these people this time of year without having to go through the additional costs and time to obtain permits. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Kosky, what is the maximum weight per axle that one of your trucks, any of the trucks, could reach, and how much does that exceed the seasonal weight limit?
Well, it depends on the road. Obviously, there's every road can be different. It could be a 5-ton road, 7, 9. Typically, like our trucks, you know, we can't exceed 10 tons per axle any time of year. And so most of the time, at least how we operate our company, we don't have trucks that are over 10 tons per axle. If you have multiple axles, a lot of times you can still pump a tank and get down the road and let's say a 7-ton road, you know, you might not be able to fully fill the truck at that point, but in some instances, you know, you might need to pump, let's say, 1,500 or 2,000 gallons, and that still might enable you to stay below a lot of the limits, you know, the majority of roads, especially asphalt roads.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thanks for your testimony.
You,
we have one last testifier then. And welcome, and please give us your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity for letting us speak with you today. I am here to testify in favor of HF3339. I'm Cindy Tiemann, co-owner of Fiddler Pumping out of Royalton. We're a licensed septic maintenance company providing wastewater pumping and maintenance to a 5-county area in central Minnesota. I'm a certified septic maintainer, service provider, type 4 wastewater operator, and I also have a 30-year work history as a registered nurse certified in public health. In years such as this, colder than average temperatures and minimal snow cover has led to many customers' calls relating to frozen septic systems. When a customer's septic line or drain field freezes, it can cause raw sewage into the to back up into the homes, as Brian has mentioned. In many of these instances, the only way a customer can continue to use any water is to monitor the depth in the septic tank and then have it pumped every time it backs up. Depending on the size of their tank and water use, the family may require pumping every 2 to 4 weeks until the grounds thaw. This winter, our company has provided wastewater removal to over 450 residences with frozen lines and drain fields. In our area, we estimate up to one half of the services we provide are on seasonal limit roads. This means without the governor's exemption this year, we would not legally be able to provide needed services during seasonal load limit dates to roughly 225 of those homes in the area until the ground thaws. Every year, septic maintenance owners like myself wait for the governor's exemption and pray it will be given. As we wait, we ask ourselves, if we aren't given the exemption, do we consider breaking the law to do what we know is in the best interest for the health and safety of our customers with sewage in their homes, or do we tell them that there's nothing that we can do to receive until we receive authorization? But it would be easy to tell them to stay in a hotel for a few nights until the authorization is received. But what about customers on limited resources or the elderly with limited resources or family to assist them? Passing HF 3339 will ensure we can legally protect the health and safety of all of our customers on seasonal weight limit roads as soon as they call us, rather than waiting for us to receive special road permissions. I also believe passing HF 3339 will save taxpayer dollars in the coming years, as this issue seems to continue to be happening and there will no longer be the required annual research and review by different people and entities that have to work on this every year. Madam Chair, thank you for your time and attention on this.
Thank you, Ms. Thiemann. Are there any questions from the committee? Any further comments, those who wish to testify for or against the bill?
Madam Chair,
we do have one more. Sorry.
Sorry.
Yes.
I do have six individuals who did send in testimony. Two of those were sent in earlier than this morning, and I passed those out to you. I can either get copies to you of those, or I could read them to you at this point.
Ms. Thiemann, I think we'll ask the page to collect those from you, and we can have those distributed.
Thank you.
So, thank you. We do have another testifier. Sorry, Mr. Western. Welcome, sir.
My name is Kevin Western. I'm the state bridge engineer for MnDOT. Madam Chairman, I am here today to express some concern and say that we would be against this bill the way it is written at this time for bridges. Our bridges have been rated based on a FHWA. It's called Equation B. It's really related to bridges. And we look at a family of different bridges with different axle configurations and different weights on those vehicles. Over the years, we have been in front of the legislature and looking at increasing the limits, and we have increased the limits by 10% for winter hauling on our bridges, and we've accounted for that within that permit. So we've basically set this bar that we've evaluated to. Any bridges that do not meet that level have been posted. The language, the way it is written, basically takes that equation B with 10% on top of it off the table. And so all of the bridges that we have in the state that now do not have any issues with legal vehicles going over them, we will have to evaluate every one of them and come up with a posting sign for every one of those bridges. And that creates a really difficult situation for us. We have met. We met outside with the author of the bill and some of the other folks, and they seem to understand, and we would be willing to work with them in coming up with some language that would account for that 10% increase and where they could go above the level B like we've done for the other vehicles, and then hopefully that would be something that would also meet a high enough level for the companies.
All right. Representative Barr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, would you be okay changing the language to meet federal bridge law? So basically whatever the bridge, because I'm familiar with the bridge law, so if we change the language to meet the bridge law, which would add a few more steerable axles, you could start adding some weight to this, to the trucks. Would you be okay with language like that?
Mr. Western?
Madam Chairman and Representative, yes, we will look at that. We believe that will work. Again, we've taken that FHWA bridge formula, and that's basically the basis behind all of our vehicles. And again, we have went 10% over that on other other vehicles.
Right. So, Madam Lucero, do you have some follow-up comments? I don't think we have any other questions.
I just put that
goal. I'm sorry, we do. Representative Joaquim, let's do that first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't sure if it was just questions for the testifier or for the author. Is it okay to ask?
Yes, let's go ahead. Sure.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Just question. I completely understand some of the need, especially if the timing on the exemptions aren't meeting customer standards and the hardship. I get a little concerned, though, that we're doing a blanket exemption, so it's not just in case of emergency. It's at any time. And I'm wondering if there's anybody here from, have you talked to the folks at the counties and townships since their roads are going to be the ones that are the most impacted during the spring thaw?
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, that's what I was going to say, is we did mention, I can't remember the name, but it was, she was from the county, and she, and I expressed the thought that we're absolutely willing to look at this language. It's on its way to transportation finance, completely amenable to looking at how we might be able to improve the language to satisfy some of these concerns and other concerns that have been raised.
Thank you.
So, Representative Lucero, it sounds like there's a few things you're going to kind of pay attention to here before it gets to the next committee. So that'd be great. Do you want to have a final comment?
I appreciate the support. I appreciate the latitude in allowing us to come up with some additional language with the intention of an amendment then to satisfy some of these stakeholders by the next committee.
Very good. I'll renew my motion that House File 3339 be referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks,
Thank
Representative.
You.
Next up, we have Representative Anselmo, House File 3935. Oh, I guess we are looking for him, so I wonder if we've showed. Is Representative O'Neill here? Okay. All right. So we'll move then. We'll take up House File 3726. Representative O'Neill. Representative, I'll make a motion that your bill come before the committee and be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. So, and I understand we have an amendment, but that's being passed out or soon to be. So maybe you want to just go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I speak just to the amendment just ever so briefly? It's really just a drafting error that was an oversight in the drafting. And as you look at it, it basically disallows to transfer out of your possession to a family member a car so that it wouldn't be subject to ignition interlock. So it's just a little loophole that should have been caught when we were drafting. To the bill, Madam Chair and members. So this is about ignition interlock. This is keeping our roads safer. I've been in public safety. This is my sixth year in public safety, and we've been talking at great length this year about how to keep our roads safer. This is another one of those bills on how to keep our roads safer. This would make ignition interlock mandatory after the second offense. And right now, the current law says after the first offense over 0.16, if you want to get your license back, you have to enroll in ignition interlock. And any time after that, so any other offenses, if you want your license back, you have to enroll in ignition interlock, which sounds like a great idea. But what's actually happening out there is that people are just driving without their license. So they're still continuing to drive. They're continuing to drink. They're continuing to be a danger on the roads. So we have a big problem. Otherwise, they just don't drive, which would be fine because that keeps everybody safe. But There was a study done recently, Madam Chair and members, from the Office of Traffic Safety in 2015, and it found that only 14.5% of revoked drivers actually entered the ignition interlock program, which means about 85.5% were either driving illegally or they just chose not to drive. And it's a little hard to know which was which, but MAD seems to think, so Mothers Against Drunk Driving has long contended that between 50 and 75% of those just convicted just continue to drink and drive. So this would change it so that it would be mandatory to put on their vehicles. And again, that amendment would be so that you can't just transfer your vehicle to a family member and get around it that way. Something else that's really important about this particular change that we're doing is removing driving with after revocation from the state payable list. So some years ago, we decided as a state it was a good idea to add a whole bunch of offenses like traffic tickets and such to the list of payables. Well, now this is on the list of payables, and you don't have to go before a judge, which, by the way, is a great deterrent. If you go before a judge and you've had a DWI, a first time, a second time, a third time, it's a great deterrent not to do it again. But unfortunately, right now, it is on the list of payables, and so it would remove it from the list of payables. And the last thing I want to say is the time period. So if you are second offense in 10 years, so that's a second offense in 10 years or a third offense for lifetime, and it's over 0.08 but under 0.16. So you are between legally intoxicated and doubly legally intoxicated. That's a 1 year to be an ignition interlock. And it's 2 years with that same time period of a second offense in 10 years or a third offense in a lifetime, but you're over double the legal limit. So that's a 2 year on ignition interlock. And that's essentially what the bill does. And I do have a testifier here if I forgot anything or if you would like to add anything.
Mr. Cohen, is it?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Cohen. I am one of the owners of Smart Start Minnesota, and I have been deeply involved in the ignition interlock program long before there was even an ignition interlock program in Minnesota. I'm a lawyer by trade. I've been a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years, so I have a fairly extensive knowledge of this program and how it works and what these changes would be, and quite simply, I'm here to answer any questions, should you have any.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this forward. My question is with respect to an offender, do they have more than one vendor to be able to choose who provides the service to them?
Mr. Cohen?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Hertas. There are five vendors certified in the state of Minnesota, and the state requires that we have statewide coverage. So every vendor is required to be no more than 50 miles from every point in the state of Minnesota. So people have a wide variety of vendors to choose from.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add one thing, too. I forgot to talk about informa pauperis. So if that person cannot afford the ignition interlock, the company themselves actually have been paying for those. So it's not a cost to the state.
But that was a question I had. Are there other questions? Are there folks in the audience who wish to testify for or against? Okay. Well, very good then. We have the amendment. We have to. I guess we. We are awaiting the amendment. So perhaps just describe the amendment for us, if you would, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the drafting, it was intended that we would close the loophole of being able to transfer the car to a family member and thus avoid the ignition interlock program altogether and then continue to drive. It would, you know, it's a great way to get around it. So this closes that loophole, Madam Chair.
Okay, very good. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Neill, remind me again then, isn't it the ignition interlock is based on the driver who has the title to the car or the driver who has access to all the other cars that are in a family? It's been a while since I've dealt with this issue.
Who wants to do that, Mr. Cohen?
Madam Chair, Representative Joaquin, the way the bill is written, I believe, it's designed to put the ignition interlock requirement on the driver who was operating a car. What this, there is an exemption that's part of this bill. And the exemption is for DUI offenders who do not have, they don't own or lease a vehicle. And so what that section of the bill and what the amendment does is it prevents people, it allows people who don't have a car an exemption from putting an ignition interlock on their vehicle. If they, it seems beyond the pale, essentially, to ask somebody who doesn't own a vehicle to go buy one so they can participate in the ignition interlock program. But it also requires that not only do they not own a vehicle or lease one, but they get no driving offenses during their revocation period. So the goal ultimately is to exempt out people who legitimately do not own cars or didn't own a car at the time of the offense. So I hope I've explained that well.
Representative Ibrahim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Neal, I think it, maybe I was mixed. I was more thinking about with the title, like in our family we have five drivers, five cars, but my husband and I are on different titles. So remind me again, if I have the title on one car, but my husband has access to it and he has to have the ignition interlock, does it go on both vehicles, or does this amendment change how that transaction happens?
Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, I'd actually like to defer to the House counsel. That's a little part I'm not so sure of. If they want to,
I just want to make sure the amendment doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. We have counsel, Mr. Johnson, here with us today, so he gets a chance to give us some advice. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As I understand it, it's sort of a two-part question. What goes on right now with the ignition interlock, and how would this bill affect or change that? The question for what goes on right now, if a person is eligible for a limited license and can get ignition interlock, they can then only drive a motor vehicle that's equipped with the ignition interlock system. So there would be no requirement under current law that another family or household member vehicle be equipped with it if the person does not and cannot drive it. This bill essentially follows the same process, mm-hmm. in that if somebody is in a household where there are multiple vehicles and that person has access to those multiple vehicles, then that person would be required to be on the ignition interlock program regardless of whose name the vehicle was titled in. And as Representative O'Neill indicated, the goal there would be that if the husband, for example, got the DWI, he could not immediately transfer that vehicle to the wife's name to avoid it. But if there was a vehicle owned by somebody else in the family and or in the household and the person had no access to that vehicle, did not have permission to drive that vehicle, it would not be required that you put it on that vehicle.
Thank you.
Okay. And perhaps I might ask too then, so it sounds like we're closing loopholes. Is there a loophole? So if a person doesn't own a vehicle at the time that they get a DWI, and if they go out and buy a vehicle, I mean, obviously you assume that this penalty, affects them, but does we have to address that in the bill?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
That would be a bit of a policy decision, I suppose, but currently if you are eligible for license reinstatement through the ignition interlock program, which means you get a limited license, then any vehicle you drive has to be equipped with the ignition interlock, with an exception for some employer-owned vehicles. But if it's your vehicle, whether you buy it before the DWI, after the DWI, if you're going to be driving it with your limited license, it must be equipped with the ignition interlock program. I hope that answers the question.
Yep, that does. Great, thank you. And we do have the A1 amendment, the author's amendment, and I'll move your amendment, Representative. Any questions? Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those are nay. Okay. The amendment prevails. Very good. Now to the bill. Any final last comments or questions? All right. Seeing none. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing this bill forward, Representative. Could you just, I know we're just briefly, just talk about if there's a deterrence effects with interlocks. I'm not sure if there is or isn't necessarily, but probably more importantly, is there an opportunity for recovery, and that, is there any data that has that, so that when people get a DWI, if they have a substance abuse problem, that it allows them to continue to work and such, but also work on recovery?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kosnick. So I believe the testifier has some statistics as to how well ignition interlock works, which I know it's very well. I just don't know the number off the top of my head. And yes, and so you actually pointed out something really, really important that I did not say, which is if they can continue to drive, they can continue to work, they can get to treatment, they can stay connected to their family and communities, which is all really, really good for sobriety. So this is a great tool, an additional tool that they can have and get that sobriety back.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Cohen?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, there are a number of studies that have been done that show that not only does having the interlock on the car greatly reduce potential recidivism while the device is on, but it continues long after. In fact, in the study done by the state of Minnesota, they anticipate that the recidivism rates are less than half of those who don't do ignition interlock, so there is a substantial benefit by doing the interlock long-term on sobriety and not reoffending.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the bill and look forward to supporting it.
Very good. So with that, Representative, I'll renew my motion that House File 3726 be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so we're going to go next to Representative Barr Arsville. And that is House File 3703.
Okay. And, I keep losing my notes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, yes, do you want to move your bill then, Representative Barr? And it is going to Transportation Finance.
I move House File 3703 for referral to Transportation Finance.
Very good. Tell us all about it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 3703 would require MnDOT to modify its Highway Investment Plan, or MnSHIP, to prioritize handling congestion specifically in the metro area. Most of you know that Minnesota's 12,000-mile state highway plays a key role in our economic quality of life, as well as the quality of life of our families. I want you to know that currently in the MnSHIP plan, there's only $240 million earmarked for congestion or mobility relief over the next 20 years. I'd also like to point out that in his State of the State address last week, Governor Dayton said, another crucial area for infrastructure investments is in transportation. Everyone driving in our state knows that traffic congestion and highway conditions keep getting worse, wasting their time and straining their sanity. And I would agree with that. This legislation would require MnDOT to allocate funds that are sufficient to have an impact on congestion. Currently, user fee lanes are prioritized over general purpose lanes, and more recently in this committee we've had discussion around implementing toll roads broadly throughout the Twin Cities, which would contribute to congestion. That's why it's critical that MnDOT build requirements into the MnSHIP plan and incorporate those requirements into the statewide multimodal transportation plan. With that, Madam Chair, we do have someone to testify on behalf of the bill.
Very good. Do you want to introduce yourself, please, and let us know who you represent?
Madam Chair, Kim Crockett with Center of the American Experiment. I was just checking to see if we're going to have the PowerPoint up, or we have hard copies for members?
Okay. Correct. We've got the hard copies are passed out.
You also have copies of the congestion report that we prepared earlier this year with transportation expert Randall O'Toole called Twin Cities Traffic Congestion, It's No Accident.
And those are being handed out, Ms. Crockett.
Oh, okay. Should I wait a moment? Or?
No, I think you can go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I was told I had just a couple minutes. The congestion, I thought about it as I was driving in. I left about an hour earlier than I think I should have had to make sure that I got to the Capitol on time, because between Golden Valley and St. Paul, it's completely unpredictable in terms of traffic congestion. One of the slides that you'll see shows that this is no accident. It's been a matter of policy. There's a quote from the Metropolitan Council, quote, "The council recognizes that congestion will not be eliminated or significantly reduced in the metropolitan area," close quote. That is its stated policy, and you can find it throughout their Thrive 2040 plan. Another quote is from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. "Since 2010, MnDOT's strategy has shifted from reducing congestion toward providing alternatives to congested travel," close quote. That includes bicycle paths, pedestrian ways, and, of course, a large dedication of dollars to light rail transportation or light rail transit. House File 3703 takes on this problem. The next slide shows a declining commitment that Representative Barr referred to for congestion relief. Since 2009, it's gone from 6.9% of the budget down to about 1% in 2017. And the next slide shows that trains, the sort of main piece of the 2040 transportation plan of the Metropolitan Council, which has greatly influenced MnDOT policy, is making congestion worse. The University of Minnesota study concluded that the traffic on University Avenue has now moved on to 94, and speeds have dropped greatly between the two downtowns. Also, Hiawatha's line has a problem with signals priority that has greatly increased traffic time on that road as well. And the answer that we've been getting is more bikes, more walking. The Twin Cities area has a congestion problem, and the time wasted in traffic has quadrupled between 1982 and 2014. We also have four of the top worst bottlenecks in the country. And on the next slide, I identified where they are, though I'm sure most people who drive or visit the Twin Cities know as well. So we have four of the 100 worst bottlenecks in the United States. Next slide is, you got to look at comparable cities, places like Indianapolis and Kansas City, who are actually dealing with growth and congestion successfully. I want to draw your attention to the fact that we have fewer lane miles per million than we did in 1982. You may recall that we released the Transportation Policy Blueprint. I'm thrilled to note that the legislature adopted a lot of our recommendations last year in the transportation bill. I brought one hard copy if anybody's looking for it. It's online. In the blueprint, we recommended that the state adopt, and this is Bill 3703 essentially, a policy at MnDOT to reduce congestion on roadways 20% over a 10-year period. So that would mean, for example, 20% by 2020. It would require MnDOT to create a congestion relief plan and devote more state bonding and existing taxes to accomplishing that. I think a lot of that was in the transportation bill. So we would offer a friendly amendment to 3703 to be specific with MnDOT. I don't know that 20% over 10 years is the exact number. You'd want to consult a little more broadly on that. But the point is to give them a goal and a deadline. I point out in the next slide that if you doubt that MnDOT can achieve a goal, a big goal, they did it. Back in 2003, they set out, it was called Towards Zero Deaths, and they achieved the third largest drop in road fatalities in the nation under that program. So if you have the right leadership at the top and the right policy directions coming from the legislature, MnDOT can achieve great things, including congestion relief. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Crockett. Did you have other testifiers at this point then, Representative?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Were there questions from the committee? or someone from the audience wishes to testify? Okay. I see Mr. Gieske. So, welcome, Mr. Gieske. Find you a chair there and welcome and give us your name and who you represent.
All right. My name is Mark Gieske. I'm the director of the Transportation System Management Office at MnDOT. And I just had a few pieces of information I wanted to share with you about what the impacts of this bill would be on the program. So starting out looking at the changing of MnSHIP to include a higher priority for Twin Cities mobility, we go through a fairly extensive process when we put MnSHIP together. So this would override both the process that we did with public input, not to mention the technical analysis that was done, that told us that what we needed to do was preserve the system. That process took about 18 months to go through with the public to find that out. During the latest plan update, the public and other stakeholders and partners made it pretty clear to us that their priority should be to take care of what we have first and then look to those other priorities. So then moving on to the congestion reduction goal. With our current resources that we need to preserve Minnesota's aging transportation system, over the next 20 years we're planning to spend about 70% of that on repairing or replacing bridges, pavements, and other kinds of roadside infrastructure. So just to kind of put a number on that for folks, that's about $14 billion over the 20-year time span of MnSHIP. Also currently in MnSHIP, we did identify what investment levels it would take to reach other outcomes other than the one that MnSHIP puts forward. And we did analyze a mobility outcome that would essentially meet all the plans that had been developed by MnDOT Met Council for different kinds of mobility projects within the Twin Cities. That added up to $4.7 billion. And this is what it included. It included adding capacity, which currently means managed lanes or MnSHIP-style lanes, on 10 corridors, 20 to 24 spot mobility improvements, 2 to 3 larger kind of investments, and then adding some technology, cameras, lane control devices, things like that. So that's over a 20-year period. That's the amount of projects that we could do with $4.7 billion. Currently, about 3% or less of our trunk highway pavements and bridges are in poor condition. But if we were to enact this legislation, and let's say we agreed that that amount of spending, $4.7 billion, was an appreciable reduction, I don't know that it's 20%. I'm pretty sure we won't be able to reduce it 20%. But if you said that's an appreciable reduction, you would have to take that money from the bridge and pavement preservation program. You would probably end up at the end of 20 years with pavements in excess of 20 to 30% poor and bridges over 20% poor at the end of 20 years. Not to mention then that if you divert all of that money away from those, when you finally do get around to rehabilitating them later, they're going to be more expensive than they were to maintain in the first place. The last bullet on that then is the legislation would end up resulting in diverting money from greater Minnesota to the metro area. Right now, like I said, we spend 70% of our money on asset preservation. About 60% of that or so is in the outstate greater Minnesota area. And so to make that kind of reduction, some of it would come from there. Then a comment on the dynamic shoulders and general purpose lanes. This bill eliminates the MnPass lanes as a tool available to us. MnPass is really kind of one of our key strategies. It does provide a congestion-free option for commuters during peak travel times. A single MnPass lane carries twice as many people as a single general purpose lane. During peak hour congestion, buses and commuters can plan for and rely on a 50 to 55 mile an hour trip in a MnPass lane. And outside of peak travel times, it's open to the general public. So that's a tool we would not like to have taken away. And then finally, just kind of an overall observation on developing that number of projects. MnSHIP doesn't identify specific projects. But there are state and federal laws that have to be followed when you develop projects. And we assume when we do Midship that that is how they will develop. If we had a lot of these kinds of expansion projects, much more so than we do now, we would have to keep in mind that there's environmental justice and other practical concerns about how much can you widen facilities in the metro area without disrupting communities, tearing down homes and businesses along the way. That concludes my comments.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gieske. Representative Hornstein, question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Gieske. What are we up to in terms of the cost per mile to lane mile to develop new capacity?
Mr. Gieske?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that number offhand. It varies considerably from metro to rural, but I don't have that number with me.
You know, maybe a ballpark figure for you to add another lane. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Sorry about that. If we were to add another lane to 494, for example, in the metro area, how much would that cost per mile?
Mr. Gieske?
Still don't.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know how much it would cost. I just know that probably the right-of-way costs would be just extremely high because everything is boxed in now. So to make anything wider means you have to move everything out farther.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hornstein?
And just one more question. The report that was referenced compared basically said Kansas City and Indianapolis have more lane miles and are less congested, but I think they have about approximately 2 million metro area, and we're at 3.4 million, so they're considerably smaller metro areas. Is there any metro area in the country that you know of that is reducing congestion from a significant expansion? You know, I have family in Los Angeles, for example, and I've been visiting them all my life, and I remember when the San Diego freeway was like three lanes on each side, and now I think it's 8 or 10 on each side, and it's still bumper to bumper. And so I think that's kind of what we see all around the country. Is there any place where this strategy has actually been successful that you know of?
Mr. Gieske?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not that I know of. I think most everyone has concluded that you can't build your way out of congestion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Representative Joaquim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gieske, I want to ask, too, you mentioned the technical expertise that have gone into making the plan. I'm sure maybe if you could go over the technical expertise that goes into making a pavement management plan, because that was one of my main concerns. Having served on a city council for 9 years, I know how much thought went into us figuring out where that break point is on roads for the cost of maintaining and doing mills and overlays, and then you hit the break point where you end up having to do a total reconstruct, and if you can maintain the life of the road longer, it costs you a lot less. So I missed the first percentage you said of where we're at on poor lanes, and then I did hear the 20 to 30% of our roads would be in poor quality, which means a lot of money on reconstruct. So if you could go over that again, thank you.
Mr. Gieske?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so right now today, our pavements are not that bad. They're around the 3% poor. In Midship, with current funding, they get worse. They get up there in around the 10% to 15% poor range, depending upon which part of the system you're on. But what you said is exactly true. If you don't have the money to improve the roads, to maintain the roads at the right time in their life cycle and allow them to deteriorate to the point where they can only be reconstructed, then you have no option but to rebuild them. The cheaper alternatives are no longer available. So in that setting, with that amount of money not available, the percentage poor would be upwards of 20 to 30%. We didn't actually run a model with that low of a level investment, so I don't know the exact number.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Gieske. And I did hear you also say there's plenty of studies out there that show that we can't build our way, just build our way out of congestion. And I guess that's maybe Representative Barr, that's the probably major concern I have with the language in your bill is it's the diverting of the funds away from maintaining what we have and then also only approaching the congestion issue with one mode instead of a multi-modal approach. So just more comments.
And on that note, we've heard that statement over and over and over and over again, and I'm not sure I buy it, but I mean, if you could show us, Mr. Giesecke, the studies that show that we can't build ourselves out of the out of congestion, we'd appreciate that. Certainly, if you, if you were to reduce from four lanes to two lanes, you'd find out that actually, yeah, we've got seriously worse problems. So there must be a balance, and maybe this is the committee to actually understand, what this is all about, because certainly there's a point where putting some more lanes on works. So maybe share with that, share with us if you could, please. So we'll wait for that.
Okay.
All right. Represent a follow-up?
Madam Chair, I would love to have some time maybe after deadlines to have us maybe take a fuller approach on how to manage congestion instead of just having one group come in and talk about it. So that'd be a great maybe interim little thing,
sure,
or after deadline thing we can do.
Thank you. Representative Bernard, I'm sorry, Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, and maybe Mr. Giesecke, too. I just want to make sure that I'm clear in what this bill does. We're really talking about reprioritizing the SHIP projects and the programs that are there, and this is a statewide budgeting area. So I think in your comments, Mr. Giesecke, you said earlier that this has potential of pulling dollars away from general maintenance and so forth in greater Minnesota as well. So am I correct that this bill does not reprioritize just the metro district's budget, but also the entire state's? Is that the intention?
Maybe Representative Barr, do you want to address that?
I'll speak to that if that's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was not the intent, and we are looking at doing an amendment so that we make it clear that it's just to reprioritize the metro area budget of the program. So thank you for asking that question.
Representative Bernardi.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. My question was about diverting billions of dollars out of the rural roadways to pay for this, and so I understand now that you're going to do an amendment to help prevent that. So now our testifier, Mr. Giesecke, did I say that right? Yes. Can you say, now knowing those parameters, doing expansion in the metropolitan area costing like $4.7 billion over the next 20 years, what would be the results of that without any new dollars?
Mr. Giesecke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so in the currently published 10-year plan, the Metro District has about $3.1 billion in 10 years. So to make math easy, I'll just say that's about $6 billion in 20 years. So if we had to come up with $4 billion additional for mobility, that would severely restrict what Metro District could do for bridge and pavement maintenance. Again, a lot of it depends on what you consider some appreciable change in congestion, which is the way the bill is written. Without knowing that, I can't predict exactly.
A follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So I have concerns about the way the bill reads now, that it's taking out of greater Minnesota. I have concerns that it doesn't have new dollars to put into it. And then secondly, I wanted to ask you the question regarding the FAST Act and MAP 21. You have requirements that you must reach on your interstates. Otherwise, you can lose federal funding. And expansion doesn't mean you get to apply your dollars to take care of what we have. Can you explain the impacts on our system?
Mr. Giesecke?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, under the MAP 21 and FAST Act federal rules, there are certain targets that we need to hit. So the interstate must be maintained in a certain condition. Bridges need to be maintained in a certain condition. And if we fail to meet that, then they will have us redirect our money to pavement condition kinds of projects and bridge condition kinds of projects. So there are also targets on the national highway system. There are some restrictions on that too, although it's not quite as strict as the interstate and the bridges. But the FHWA would be able to require us to redirect our spending back if we started to not meet our targets.
And Madam Chair, and could that be a possibility that this could happen, that we wouldn't meet the requirements to receive our federal dollars?
Mr. Giesecke?
Madam Chair, yes, I think it would definitely be a consequence.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with this information being brought forward with this possibility of an amendment, is that something that this committee will have a chance to review before it gets moved on? I mean, it seems like a pretty major change.
Mr. Carlson, the bill is going to go to Transportation Finance, and they'll be looking at numbers. So that's probably more in their jurisdiction, actually. Representative Mason?
I just have a general question of the author. Last year, when we were listening to all the reporting from MnDOT, again and again, what we kept hearing, that all they have the money to do is primarily for preservation, and they will try to alternate or try to adjust certain intersections so traffic moves faster. That's what I kept hearing. I mean, there's not enough money in the system. And again, a number of years ago, I used to be on a city council when we were asking for money. MnDOT was not funded adequately then. It's not funded adequately now. And you're going to divert money now from the limited stuff that they're doing to do another plan. Is that what I'm understanding this bill does?
Maybe Representative Barr, would you want to respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Mason. What I'm saying is that I would like to see them reprioritize their existing plan. And, you know, I've heard here today you can't build your way out of that, but I think expansion of roadways, we also need to take into account that we're also protecting rights of ways. We can't keep diverting rights of ways to other activities because that also contributes. So I think some of it is reprioritizing and relooking at how they're choosing to spend those funds.
And I think, Representative Mason, I mean, what's missing here is really what kind of funding there will be for roads over the next 10 years and 20 years. I mean, the assumption is it's zero additional at this point. So I think that's probably not a factual assumption. So. All right. Other questions? Okay. Seeing none, then. Representative Hornstein.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment briefly on your last statement. Now, this bill is massively expensive, we've heard. We don't have the money to pay for it, and it's not going to solve the problem. And if we continue to divert small amounts of general fund money for as our new source of money, as what was done in the transportation bill last year, we're just accounting for just a tiny fraction of the need, both in the metro area and statewide, for roads and bridges. So this is the absolute wrong direction to go, and I would hope we'll examine this even more closely in the Finance Committee, because this is a finance question. And again, it's fiscally irresponsible, and it's not going to solve the problem.
All right. With that, I will renew the motion to re-refer House File 3703 to the Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion prevails. Okay. Thank you, Representative Barr. And next up, Representative Roz Peterson, House File 3917. Welcome, Representative Peterson.
I know.
I'll go ahead and move your bill, House File 3917, and where is that going? That will be moving to government operations. So please go ahead and tell us about your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3917 is talking about the governance of Met Council, and as I know, we've been having conversations about Met Council scope, Met Council governance. So this specifically just looks at the governance piece of that conversation. And I want to highlight the sense of urgency. We have an opportunity that I believe the window is closing, and that's why I think it's a prudent time to talk about different options that might be available to help address this issue. House File 3917 provides reforms to the governance by providing staggered terms, which I know have been presented many times, and improvements in the process for how members are nominated and appointed to the council. This bill strikes a solid middle ground with some important reforms. These reforms differ from more drastic changes proposed in other bills. And my understanding is that these bills do not have the support of the governor, and that's the reason why we're bringing out some other options. This bill brings an important transparency, accountability, and more engagement by local officials in the selection process that are significantly lacking under current laws that direct the selection process. The bill has support of Metro Cities, which represents the cities across the metropolitan area that the Met Council's purview is under. I would appreciate this bill being included in a mix of reform ideas and would appreciate your favorable consideration, Madam Chair and members. And I do have some testifiers this afternoon, Gary Hansen, the president of Metro Cities, who is also a city council member in Eagan.
Madam Chair. Very good. Welcome, Mr. Hansen. Please give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Gary Hansen, president of Metro Cities, which represents the joint interests of cities across the metropolitan area. And I'm also, as Representative Peterson said, an Eagan City Council member. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to comment on House File 3917. And I'm certainly here to testify in support of the bill. And I want to thank Representative Peterson for introducing this legislation. The key tenets of the bill, staggered terms and reforms to the nominations process, have long been supported by Metro Cities. These are important reforms that strengthen accountability for selection of Metropolitan Council members and increase engagement by local officials in that process. These reforms also maintain a separate regional structure, which is the most effective manner to provide the regional services and infrastructure that is absolutely necessary to a strong competitive region. Metro City supports staggered terms, which balance the makeup of the council between gubernatorial administrations, provide appropriate continuity for a long-range planning body, and help alleviate political swings and mission creep on the part of the council itself. Metro Cities views staggered terms as a straightforward and common sense reform for the council. The bill's changes to the nominating committee increase participation by local officials in the process and strengthen transparency once members are nominated and before their appointment. Increased participation and greater transparency are both strongly supported by Metro Cities and are important guiding principles of our organization. Metro Cities further supports allowing city and county organizations to make local official appointments to the Metropolitan Council Nominating Committee. This change also improves participation by local governments in the selection process. House File 3917 also provides for a public comment period after the Nominating Committee makes recommendations, but before council members are appointed. This important step adds transparency and the opportunity for more adequate input from local officials and citizens. And this comment period is lacking in the nominating process under current law. Metro Cities further supports the provision in the bill requiring that a governor must explain to a nominating committee if he or she rejects the committee's recommendations. This helps provide integrity to the nominating process and additional accountability by the governor as he or she makes appointments. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I urge you to consider and support the important reforms for metropolitan governance in this bill.
Madam Chair, if I could add a couple different...
Representative Peterson.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to point out that this removes the requirement that they serve at the pleasure of the governor. I think that's an important thing to strike from current law. And as was discussed, we're really focusing on the nominating committee. We're increasing the number of members from 6 to 13. Four are local elected officials from the Association of Metro Municipalities to represent the city portion, and then three elected officials to represent the Association of Minnesota Counties, with six remaining for the governor-appointed people. And they have to focus on selecting people who actually have some experience in this area. It just can't be, you know, my BFF that, you know, help me out with this and that. They actually have to have some knowledge. And I think it is important to point out that if the governor does reject the recommendations from the nominating committee, that he has to publicly write out the reasons why. So I believe that it brings back that accountability back to the local level so that these people who are appointed are not serving underneath the governor. They're serving at the with a regional balance but also being held accountable at the local level. And that's why I think that this might be a better step in the right direction. It's certainly better than what we have today.
So, Representative, is the nominating committee then at large? We don't have one for every district.
This particular one, I do believe, still has the districts, and I'll let my next testifier address that particular issue.
Great. Welcome, Ms. Nauman.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I want to just add a couple of points, but I will answer that question first. So the bill, the nominating committee under this legislation would still be an at-large nominating committee. It would be expanded from 7 to 13 members, and a majority of those members would be required to be local officials. Metro Cities policies actually do support considering having four separate nominating committees throughout the metropolitan region, but this bill does maintain one at-large nominating committee.
But the members themselves, the Met Council members themselves, are still their district.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. 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 Metropolitan Council members would still be appointed by district. I'm sorry if I did misunderstand that question, Madam Chair.
Very good.
And okay. If I could just add a couple of
Go ahead,
just a couple of additional comments to Metro City's position. I just want to emphasize that the positions of Metro Cities have been vetted both through a task force of the organization's members as well as several policy development processes throughout the years. And I just maybe just want to stress that at times these positions have been characterized as perhaps not going far enough. Metro Cities would posit that staggered terms in and of itself would be a very significant change for the Metropolitan Council. It would serve to stabilize the council. That's good for the council. It's good for cities in the metropolitan region. It would avoid, you know, sort of increases independence from any one governor. It avoids wholesale lurching changes between administrations. And it just allows the council to be more independent from the politics of any given administration. The changes on the nominating committee process would put a level of transparency that, as Representative Peterson mentioned, is frankly missing from current law. There is a process for conducting interviews, but there is no process under current law for either commenting on members or even knowing who those members are once they're nominated and even as they're appointed. So we do believe that this bill and the positions in it are important reforms for the Metropolitan Council that, again, strike a middle ground approach, maintain a separate regional entity, which Metro City supports, but contains some important reforms.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman.
Thank you.
And one more testifier, I think.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Pruvo Hoffman. I'm the Executive Director for the Citizens League. I'm here to testify in support of House 53917, and I thank Representative Peterson and Representative Joachim for sponsoring this bill. The concepts in House 53917 are consistent with the positions of the Citizens League. As many of you know, the Citizens League position resulted from recommendations by a task force that was convened in 2015-16. That task force included elected officials, representatives from the business community, nonprofit sector, and citizen community members. And over the course of 6 months, we studied and debated various governance structures. Our recommendations call support staggered terms, an expansion of the nominating committee, and additional measures that increase transparency and accountability. While the Citizens League recommendations did not specifically detail that the majority of an expanded nominating committee consists of elected officials, as this bill does, we recognize that current law does not limit the number of elected officials who could serve in this nominating capacity. This bill 3917 also calls for a 21-day public comment period. Ours called for 14-day, and given my work in public engagement, 21 days is even better to us, and so we support this measure. Lastly, we support any measures that provide further accountability. And so this additional language in this bill that provides a detailed requirement by the governor, should he or she reject recommendations coming from this nominating committee, we also support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comments, questions from the committee? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I very much appreciate this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward. I have been one that's been maybe for more aggressive reform of the Met Council via direct election, but I've really come around to, and I've sponsored this in the past, but I've really come around to what you said, Representative Peterson, about, you know, we have an opportunity here and the window is closing. And members, you know, it's been almost 25 years since we've had any significant structural change in the Metropolitan Council. And this bill, you know, my approach, I think the approach that Representative Albright is taking, that's not going to get signed into law, and it's possibly not even going to pass the legislature. At least I know mine wouldn't. So this is one that I think we've got a shot at. You know, I think bipartisanly this is supported. I don't detect opposition from the Met Council to it, and I don't detect opposition from the executive branch. I know we have to do what we need to do irregardless of that, but I have to tell you, that's important consideration when it comes to Met Council reform. We could get this done, members. We could get this done now. We don't have to wait any longer. And 25 years is way too long to have this structure in place. And I think your bill, Representative Nash has a similar bill. I think your bill goes a little further in terms of the criteria for the candidates. And so let's go with it. I hope this is included in either as a standalone or as part of a larger bill. But I've really come around to thinking this is a very good interim approach and one that we should take bipartisanly. So thank you.
Does anyone from the audience wish to testify for or against? Okay. All right. Seeing none, then I'll renew the motion to re-refer House File 3917 to the Government Operations Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. We're going to move to Representative New, 3923. And Representative New, next. So, Representative New, do you want to go ahead and move House File 3923 and re-refer that to the Environment and Natural Policies and Finance Committee?
I do. That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, very good. Please proceed and tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you. And before I start quickly, this is the first time I've introduced a bill in transportation policy, and I do have treats. So,
oh, perfectly timed. Perfectly
right.
Timed. But
mid-afternoon, it's good timing, right?
Yep, absolutely. Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, just for as point of reference to members of the committee, the reason that I am bringing forth this bill and the reason I started looking into this is that in January of this year, a little boy in my district was killed after being hit by a man on a snowmobile who had been drinking. This man had his license revoked three times and had an ignition interlock. He was also impaired at the time of the accident. So with that as a background, what this bill does particularly, and perhaps Mr. Johnson can correct me if I get any of this wrong, it's a bit complicated, but current law states that if you receive a DWI on an ATV or a snowmobile, you will lose your driving privileges on those vehicles for 1 year. In addition, you can lose your driver's license for 30 to 90 days. Currently in statute, there is an exemption for a first-time offense. However, these penalties do not move in the other direction. If you receive a DWI in your car, you have the DWI penalties for that, but you do not have any penalties regarding snowmobiles and ATVs. So basically what this bill will do is relink those things so that if you get a DWI on an ATV or snowmobile, or if you get a DWI in your automobile, those penalties will be relinked. And my understanding is that in previous years those actually were linked. This is just bringing them back together. In addition, this bill will remove the first-time offender exemption if that DWI occurs on a snowmobile or ATV. And I do have two testifiers for the bill, Madam Chair.
All right, very good. Please, to the definition and description, Representative Carlson?
Yes, Madam Chair, real quick. And does it also include motorboats, the linking?
Representative, no.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ask that ourselves.
And Representative Carlson. Actually, right now, it does not.
Okay.
Currently, motorboats are covered under a different statute. And so, frankly, to keep this tight and narrow, I am literally linking current statute again, and I did not get into the issue of bringing in other things. Frankly, I am open to that moving forward.
So, Representative, let's hear from your testifier then.
Great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christian Franzen, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota United Snowmobile Association. MinUSA is a statewide association of snowmobiler families. In that, we're here to support House File 3923. Since the tragedy in Chisago County, we have sought out law enforcement and others to talk about solutions that may help prevent another such tragedy. We feel that House File 3923 is a step in the right direction, and we look forward to working with you as well as the bill moves through this process. We'd like to thank the bill author for her leadership and effort. We ask that you support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. No. Was there another testifier?
I believe so. We have someone from the DNR as well.
Welcome, sir, and give us your name and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Rodman Smith. I'm the Director of Enforcement for the Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair?
Sorry, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I'd like to thank Representative New for bringing this forward. There are some tweaks that we'd like to look at. We've talked to the author about, and I've talked to the Department of Public Safety. Nothing earth-shattering. We do want to clarify, too, whether or not this does pertain to motorboats. I believe it might, but I would like to talk with counsel. DUI law is very complex, and so we just want to make sure that this does apply to motorboats. So between now and this next stop, we'll be getting all this figured out. But we're all headed in the right direction.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Yep. I believe Mr. Johnson has a little bit of clarification for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on the question of motorboats, there are two sections in this bill. The first section applies only to snowmobile and ATVs. The second section would apply to motorboats. And in that situation, a person who picked up a DWI on a snowmobile, motorboat, or ATV would be subject to a full driver's license revocation. All three of those sort of off-road modes of transportation are treated the same under that statute.
Thank you. Okay, so we have, Representative Hertas' question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and for law enforcement. I've been snowmobiling, and you come around a corner, and then all of a sudden there's a sobriety check and blow in the pipe to go any further. I'm wondering, shouldn't operators of snowmobiles be protected with their liberties to have probable cause to be doing that, as opposed to just having these checkpoints?
Madam Chair, Representative Hertas, we have not done those types of operations for several years. I believe it was quite a few years ago where DUI checkpoints were found unconstitutional, and so we have not done those for a number of years. The probable cause standards are the same for a snowmobile ATV currently, or a snowmobile DUI, ATV DUI, motorboat DUI, just like it is a motor vehicle. So there needs to be some probable cause in order to stop that individual.
All right. Well, that's good to clarify. Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. I guess the years have flown by.
Okay. Is there anyone else who wishes to have a question? Anyone wishing to testify for or against the bill? Okay, seeing none, I'll go ahead and renew my motion to re-refer House File 3923 to the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative. And next up, Representative Anselmo. And House File 3935.
Get through this, huh?
Welcome, Representative Anselmo. I'll go ahead and make motion that House File 3935 come before the committee, and we'll be laying it over for possible inclusion. So I'm going to go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Dario Anselmo. House File 3935 is a bill to change the revocation from right now it's unlimited. That you can keep getting your driver's license back to setting a limit of 5 DWIs. At that point, you would forfeit your license for life. After meeting with a number of people, task force, study groups, parents, prosecutors, families, it made some sense that we add a redemption period at the end. After 10 years, you could petition to get your license back. This law is modeled on what Oregon, Florida, and Alaska have done. 12 other states have done bills like this. The penalty structure that we have in place would stay in place for your first, three, or fourth, as well as your fifth. It's a felony offense after 4 years. You're looking at jail time and forfeiture of a vehicle. And at five, we're looking to add a revocation to that bill. I'm happy to take some questions on that and can give any history or background, but it's an important bill. We're looking to try to find a way to save lives. I just really want to remind people that are out there that they should not be drinking and driving, and that driving is a privilege, it's not a right, and we need to find a way to make this better. Thank you.
All right. Did you have testifiers to the bill?
You know what? Just me, Madam Chair.
Okay. You're pretty good. Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick clarifying question. Did you say this is actually being laid over, or is it supposed to go to civil law?
We'll wait to hear the questions and the comments and so on, any further testimony, but at this point, we'll bling it over.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that there's a lot of stuff in here that should go to civil law, but of course, it's to your discretion. Quick question for the author, Representative Anselmo. First, thank you very much for bringing this forward. I know this is a really big issue on our roads, and I was kind of hoping to get a little bit more vetting in civil law, because the question I have for you probably pertains to their jurisdiction more. But on section, let me see, where was it? Oh, I've got to find it. Sorry about that. I had it marked earlier. Oh, here it is. So on page 5, on lines 5.4, you say 10 years after the date on which the person's driving privilege is revoked or canceled is when they can apply for reinstatement. But then on sections 5.6, 5.7, you say for a person that has been released from confinement, they have to wait another 10 years. So instead of 10 years from when they had their driving privileges revoked, you're adding another, you're treating the two different convictions a little bit differently in these languages, and I'm wondering why. So a person that wasn't behind bars would just have the 10 years. Someone who's been in confinement, which kind of is a loose definition, because does that mean after they've been out of prison or off paper? So these are questions that civil law would probably ask, and unfortunately I'm asking you them here.
The thought to
Representative, we do have Mr. Johnson, if there's
that would, Madam Chair, that clarify. Would be good to pull the detail out. I can tell you the intent in here is that you have to have a clean record and not have any other violations. Otherwise, it's 10 years from the last one.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, anything further there?
And Madam Chair, it would apply that if someone was in custody, that period of time would effectively be tolled. And so once released from confinement, the 10-year period would start running. I think the desire there was that someone would be free to access a motor vehicle during that 10 period a 10-year period but might have a prison sentence that would eat up some or all of that 10-year period otherwise, and therefore have no access to a motor vehicle during that period of time.
Representative Joaquin, follow-up?
So, Madam Chair, that is a little concerning. Maybe you can maybe think about that or go over that, maybe talk to some of the folks on civil law, because it does seem like you're treating the same – the two same people may have the same offense, but maybe there were collateral sanctions or an increased criminal history score that would then put that person – it was like they broke probation, so they'd have to go into prison. So now they don't get that option of having that 10 years in there. So that's something to really think about.
All right. Further comments, further questions? Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just with the author's intent and what we just heard and having read through the bill and serving on civil law, I would just, I guess, make one last plea that this be referred to that committee for the vetting. I don't think we're hearing any major concerns with the author's bringing forward here, but I think there's just some legal questions that deserve some public testimony too. Civil law meets tomorrow.
All right. Representative Mason?
Just a practical question. I agree with what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, we've seen a lot of fatalities that should not have happened. But realistically, given the way that we are structured, limited public transit, I know that there's many people that are driving without insurance, they are driving without licenses. The thought of trying to, you know, how realistic is it that we truly be able to implement this or keep track of that?
Representative Anselmo.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. I think when we went through the whole process and certainly listening to people in the task force, you know, that question came up. And it's a matter of getting people's attention. I mean, that's why so many states are doing this. And I think we are a state that believes in really rehabilitative behavior. We're sort of sometimes called the land of 10,000 treatment centers. And what does it take to make that change? And sometimes it is this sort of shift to do that. I'm certainly a supporter of having public transportation options, you know, wherever they are. But this is germane to, you know, stopping people. And I don't know, is it one life saved that makes it worthwhile, or is it five, or is it 10? You know, changing behavior. We've come a long way from when the laws changed, and having people having the mindset that, you know, if we drink and drive, we need to get our cars home, and we need to get to work, and we just need to change that. And I think we have a lot of things along the way. Ignition Interlock is part of that too, that help get people's attention, help them get help, and that's what I'd like to see. But sometimes, you know, no means to mean no, and some people shouldn't be driving, and we have to find a way to change that behavior before they start breaking more laws and getting in more trouble.
Representative Anselmo, do you have stats, the numbers, for example, on how many offenders that have committed, you know, their fifth offense?
Be
very interesting to really, you know how big that population base is.
Yes, yeah, Madam Chair, you know, thankfully that number does get smaller and smaller. You know, the first-time pool is 25,000 people a year, one out of seven Minnesotans have a DWI, so it's a scary number. We're a high state for recidivism, for all the good things that happen here, that seems to be a tougher one. You know, it drops down when you get to the felony level. It's 587. When you get to the fifth level, it's half that number. So it's a smaller pool. It's a persistent pool, and we need to change that. As people saw reported just St. Patrick's Day, which is a day where there's a little more inviting going on, that we doubled or tripled the amount of DWIs. So it's still happening, and even the land of Uber and Lyft, we somehow have to change the behavior. It's not a great idea to be drinking that much. But the number does go down, but 300 people is a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Anyone else from the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Okay, very good. With that, Representative Anselmo, I will make a motion and re-refer House, or I'm sorry, and lay over for possible inclusion, House File 3935. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Oh, we don't have to lay over. Okay. Okay. Motion prevails. Okay, bill's laid over. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Okay. All right. We'll have a few minutes to go into House File 3925, Representative Bernardi. Welcome, Representative, and do you want to go ahead and move your bill, 3925?
Yes, I'd like to move
my bill.
And
we'll be laying that over for possible inclusion, Representative.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you putting us up on the committee because we have a testifier here, so thank you very much. I would like to move House File 3925. And you said for to lay it over, is that what?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Does that mean? Okay, so that's what we'll do then. So with me, I want to get our testifier in before I probably get into all the details of the bill so that you can he can like not have to come back at 5 o'clock. But briefly, this bill is Bike Minnesota is been helping with this bill, and it helps clarify some laws that make it safer for people to bike in our communities. And then it also clarifies some language from last year in the active transportation bill that got overlooked. And I do have two amendments. Would you like to do that after our testifiers gone?
We can probably move those fairly quickly. Do we have them?
Yes, we do.
Okay, we have the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is, and that's what they were discussing up here real quickly, is that I would like to move the A1 amendment with deleting lines 1.8 to 1.10.
Oh, okay. So, members, then, on the amendment itself, so we're going to delete 1.8 and 1.9 from the amendment. And line 10, okay. Yep. Everybody clear? Okay. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Okay.
And then I'm going to offer one other amendment. And Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the other A18-0636 amendment, and that is the one that adds collaborating and working with the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development where the Department of Tourism lies and other state agencies as the commissioner deems necessary, and then my bill will be in order.
Very good. Any comments, questions on the A18? 0636. Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The first part of the bill I'm going to have my testifier talk to. And his name is Matt Moore, and he will introduce himself and his credentials. Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Moore. Please identify yourself for the record. Who you represent?
Thank you, Madam Chair Rumbeck. My name is Matt Moore. I'm here on behalf of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota and our legislative task force, which is a group of very passionate cyclists who meet to review and make positive improvements in Minnesota's bicycle laws for the operation and safety of cyclists in Minnesota. We have done our usual task this last year and have come up with some technical amendments that we believe will clarify the laws with respect to bicycles, really make them closer to best practices for safe cycling, and help both motorists, cyclists, and law enforcement understand their duties and responsibilities under the rules of the road. I think a good example is the provision that will allow a cyclist, when in a right-hand turn lane approaching intersection, to move to the left-hand side of the turn lane to allow motorists who are behind them to continue and make the right-hand turn. You may have encountered this. There'll be a cyclist ahead of you as you're approaching to make a right-hand turn. Then you have a decision. Do I try and creep around the cyclist? They're out a little bit far. Maybe I'll just wait for them. Are they turning? Are they going straight? Experienced cyclists will move kind of over to the left-hand corner of that turn lane, and that will allow motorists to proceed unimpeded with a right-hand turn actually will help traffic flow. It's more of a courtesy, but we'd like to amend the rules of the road to allow that as a standard practice for cyclists. I don't have any other formal remarks. It's a summary of the bill, but I am certainly available for any questions from the committee.
Okay. Seeing no questions at this time, we do appreciate you being here and glad we could get your testimony in. Committee's time is basically up for now. We're going to come back, though, members, after session at 5 p.m., or if session adjourns early, it'll be 15 minutes. Do you want to say that?
Yes, please.
15 minutes after session adjourns, okay, and there's three or four bills. We'll be taking up, and we'll be in room 10 at that time. So keep your packets, members, and the meeting is recessed. All right. So before us, we have House File 3795 and the A1 amendment. Were there any comments, questions regarding that? All right. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And then to the bill, any comments, final comments on the bill? All right. And a closing comment, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to thank the committee for the time, and I think this is a good bill to help save a little bit of money and then also provide better service.
Thank you. And I'll renew your motion to refer the bill to civil law. That is House File 3795, all as amended. Thank you. All in favor of 3795 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative. All right, now up is Representative Barr with House File 2733. Representative Barr.
I've never seen it now.
You want to go ahead and move your bill? House File 2733, we are going to lay it over for the time being, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Move House File 2733 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill.
All right. Go ahead with your testimony.
2733 is a bill that would eliminate a duplicated inspection. That there's a federal inspection requirement on all commercial vehicles, and the state has an overlapping commercial vehicle inspection program that actually has a cost to it that impacts all small truckers, large truckers, any commercial vehicle. It could be anything from your two men in a truck to a large trucking company. Anything that's plated in the state of Minnesota has to participate in this program. And I have eliminated that whole program and just conformed to the federal program. And then there's some language in here about any trucking company that has, or inspector that has bought any of the inspection stickers would be reimbursed for any costs there. And to speak to some of the details, I have John Hoslotten with the Minnesota Trucking Association.
All right, very good. Welcome, Mr. Hoslotten.
Yes, good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee on a long day. My name is John Hoslotten, president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. I'd hope to have one of Representative McDonald's constituents, Kevin Otto, here to speak. He was here earlier but could not stay for the evening session, so I'm just going to read his testimony on his behalf. And, of course, Minnesota Trucking Association has an elected chair, and that's Kevin's position. He is a family-owned 19-truck company that specializes in hauling power poles, and we are here today to testify in support of House File 2733. I think it's important to say up front that our organization holds two core values very tightly, safety and regulatory uniformity across the states. As a safety organization, we strongly support requiring commercial motor vehicles to undergo an annual vehicle inspection, and that these inspections must be done by a qualified inspector. As to uniformity, we also strongly believe that a truck inspection conducted by a qualified inspector should satisfy Minnesota's inspection requirements regardless of in which state the inspection occurred. And this is where we take issue with current Minnesota law. It requires nearly all Minnesota-plated trucks to be inspected by a Minnesota-certified inspector
and receive a Minnesota inspection sticker. This means that at least once a year, a Minnesota-plated truck must come back to Minnesota to be inspected, even if it operates primarily in other states. Or we can bear the expense to send one of our staff to the other state to conduct the inspection. But either way, it puts Minnesota trucking companies at an operational and economic disadvantage. Minnesota law also requires vehicle inspectors to undergo training certified by the state. Mr. Otto is a certified inspector since 1997, and he personally knows that the training program conducted by the State Patrol improves the quality of the inspection and the inspector. And we don't think that the training of current and future inspectors needs to be any less vigorous. But to reiterate, we don't believe inspections conducted by a qualified inspector in another state is any less valid. If they're conducting an inspection according to the federal requirements and the inspector is deemed qualified by that state, we believe it should be accepted in Minnesota. The real key, though, to highway safety is a commitment by truckers to put the safest equipment and drivers on the road each and every day. Annual inspections are a part of what we do every day to make sure that we're working to make Minnesota's roads safe, ensuring that everyone gets home safely. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there others that want to testify? Representative Guerra. Welcome, Colonel Langer.
Madam Chair.
Colonel Langer.
Members, for the record, my name is Matt Langer. I have the honor and privilege of serving as the Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol, and I'll keep my comments brief. If there's questions, I'll try to answer them. I also have the subject matter expert, John Olson, the commander of our Commercial Motor Vehicle Division, with us today. We're here testifying respectfully in opposition of this bill. We do think that the mandatory inspection program is a good thing for Minnesota, and it's a good thing for our roads. Our inspection program in law that the State Patrol facilitates requires inspectors to be trained by the State Patrol, and it requires those inspectors to have certain qualifications. It actually goes above and beyond what the federal government requires through the regulations, and it includes things that our inspectors in Minnesota look for beyond what the federal regulations look for. Once those truckers get their trucks inspected, they purchase a sticker. The stickers are $2 each. That covers the cost of the sticker. They affix that to the cab, and then it gives visual indication to law enforcement that truck has indeed completed the inspection. A central part of that whole program in issuing those decals is our ability to then audit those who are conducting inspections fraudulently. And there are some who don't meet the statutory requirements necessary by law to do an inspection, but they choose to do them anyway. Just for example, last year we found 115 of those fraudulent inspectors operating in our state and went after them under the law and suspended them from being in the program, enabling them to do inspections. So this bill, I understand the purpose of it, but what it would do is strip us of any ability to audit for those fraudulent inspections and to go back and try to discover the root cause of what might be going on related to commercial vehicle inspection. So for those reasons, we are opposing this bill from the Department of Public Safety in the interest of traffic safety for our state.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. Did I hear you say right that there were 115 fraudulent inspectors or inspections?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, that'd be inspectors. And that's about consistent over the past few years, 115 to 130 that we discover.
Madam Chair, Colonel Langer, on average, each of those inspectors, how many fraudulent inspections did they do?
Colonel Langer.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would vary based on how many inspections they do and what kind of an outfit they are. We do our best to facilitate anyone that wants to be an inspector can certainly become one. We don't want to hinder anybody from doing it. The more people doing it per law, the better, in our opinion, for safety.
And then one more question, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Langer, you mentioned, too, that there are some things above and beyond the federal inspections. Could you give us an example of one of those?
Colonel Langer.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the federal requirement is that those inspections are done to federal law. But there are certain parts of certain laws in Minnesota that are above and beyond the federal requirement. And so the Minnesota certified inspectors are looking for everything in the federal regulation, but they're also looking for those handful of laws that are above and beyond what the feds require. And so they'd be looking for those things as well under the current program that would not be under the proposed revision.
Madam Chair, thank you, Colonel Langer. Do you have an example of just one of those? I'm just curious.
Colonel Langer. Madam Chair, Representative, we'll see. Maybe we'll give the same one here, but Madam Chair, Representative, one of them would be the mud flap requirement on the rearmost axle is just an example, but I'm sure Representative Barr has others.
Representative Barr. One of the examples, Minnesota differs from the federal. Federal requires it's a go, no-go on tread depth for tires, pass-fail, and Minnesota requires you actually record the actual tread depth on each tire.
Thank you.
All right. Do we have another testifier then? Oh, okay. All right. Well, it seems like an interesting bill, and I don't know if you're going to reach any sort of, agreement on it. But we are at this point going to lay over. So House File 2733, I'll move to lay over and do that. Thank you, Representative Barr.
Thank you.
House File 3282, Representative Barr.
Madam Chair, I move House File 3282 be moved to the House or the Transportation Finance Committee.
That's correct. So go ahead, Representative Barr, and tell us about the bill.
Okay. First, I would like to have a we have a DE2 amendment to move.
Aha. Author's amendment. All right. Want to explain the amendment, please?
This was the compromise reached between MnDOT and myself here with the filing of the tariff instead of completely dismantling the entire program. It's more of a federal conformity issue. The tariffs will still be filled out, filed, but they will be kept at the business location instead of being filed with MnDOT. And there is a, I would like to offer also a oral amendment for one word on line 4.3, word carrier. I would like to change that to mover. So it conforms with every other place in the bill where the word mover is at.
Okay, Representative, well, I think we can incorporate that, correct? All right, good. Got it. All right, did you have more testimony yourself, Representative? Or
no, not myself, Madam Chair. Okay. I would like to introduce my testifier here, if I could remember where I wrote my notes down. Huh?
Ms. Forbes.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome, Ms. Forbes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3282. My name is Megan Forbes. I'm an attorney at the Institute for Justice. We're a nonprofit public interest law firm, and we work to repeal anti-competitive laws that limit economic opportunities. In Minnesota, we've been working for many years to improve the laws related to household goods movers inside the state. And back in 2008, we helped remove an outdated requirement that new movers pass a public convenience and necessity test, which removed an artificial cap on the number of movers allowed to work here in the state. We support this bill because it eliminates another outdated requirement. It's the requirement that moving companies have to actually file their tariffs, their report of prices, with the state. Under the amendment, movers will still have to make their tariffs available to consumers and MnDOT, but they will not have to physically file them with the state. Minnesota is currently one of only 10 states that requires movers to file tariffs with the state, and movers are also the only carriers right now in Minnesota that have to file their prices with the state. We've also learned from MnDOT that they think this process of not having to file with the state will save MnDOT approximately $100,000 over the next 5 years that could be dedicated to another use, perhaps the state trunk highway fund. We think that the filing requirement should be repealed. It creates needless red tape and doesn't provide any meaningful consumer protection. According to MnDOT, repealing the filing requirement will not have an effect on consumer protection. MnDOT has only received 4 consumer complaints related to tariff violations over what we estimate to be approximately 300,000 moves. And MnDOT would still be able to resolve consumer complaints because these tariffs would still be available to MnDOT. Nothing is changing their authority to protect consumers under this bill. In conclusion, we support this bill because we think it strikes the right balance. It allows MnDOT to continue resolving consumer complaints. It saves MnDOT some money, and it eliminates an outdated requirement that poses no benefit to the public. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Forbes. I don't see any questions. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Oh, we have a gentleman. Welcome. Come on up to the table, please. Good afternoon, sir, and give us your name and who you represent for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and committee members. I'm not much of a public speaker, so I have everything written down. My name is Howard Marcus, and I'm the owner of Associated Transportation Consultants and the executive director of the Minnesota Transport Services Association, which is the state trade association for movers. We do not support this bill. We're in opposition to it. This is not an agency bill, and this is not an industry bill. This is a bill brought forth by a third party. I have been preparing, publishing, and filing tariffs with government agencies for almost 42 years. I have assisted numerous companies getting started in the transportation industry, as well as assisting existing companies in many areas, including tariffs. House File 3282 is originally proposed was unacceptable for me and the majority of my members. The delete all amendment improved the bill, but still raises some concerns for myself and the moving association. There are some misconceptions concerning actually what a tariff is. I would like to offer the following. A tariff is a name used for the public legal document that sets forth the services the moving company offers, the conditions, restrictions regarding those services, and pricing information for determining the charges for the services provided. The tariff is incorporated by reference into the contract for carriage, the bill of lading. The reason tariffs are reviewed by regulators, MnDOT, is to ensure that the terms and prices for transportation are clearly and explicitly stated and non-discriminatory. The current Minnesota regulations relate to the manner in which the public information must be listed and the amount of advance notice to the public before changes to the public become effective. Establishment of uniform requirements has eliminated many problems regarding the meaning interpretation of service statements and a greater surety of the charges for those services. The current system provides at least a modicum of protection for the consumer while still allowing the moving company and the customer a great amount of freedom of choice. If a public authority did not review the tariffs, their validity, reasonableness, fairness, and equity would be highly questionable and be ripe for abuse, which is currently not the case. The bill as amended would retain the tariffs and the requirement that movers charge what is published in their tariff. But by using the federal regulations concerning tariffs, they remove the consumer protection safeguards that Minnesota consumers enjoy today. Under the proposed amended bill, there would be no prior notice to the public required for tariff changes. This would allow unethical moving companies to backdate changes to their tariff. One potential scenario, emailed to me by an MTSA member, is that the amendment would allow a carrier to alter their tariff at any time. Therefore, if a customer complained, a carrier could just change their tariff to render that customer's complaint invalid. We would just have to hope that the carrier would be honest. In addition, potentially a moving company could have more than one moving tariff with not only different rates but different terms and conditions and services offered based on who they were offering it to. If the end result was discriminatory or prejudicial practices, who would know? From experience, I know that if the filing requirement is eliminated, there are at least some carriers who will no longer change their tariffs. They will update their rates and charges but will not update their tariffs. They'll have no incentive to do so under the proposed amended bill. New carriers will ignore the requirement to publish unless it is required to be sent in with the registration form, insurance, and vehicle registration. There's no such requirement in the bill. The reason this works on the federal level is that the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration can fine the carriers on the spot if they find out they have no tariff. Our common goal should be provide the most protection to consumers while allowing businesses the ability to compete and grow. This amended bill will not do that. I firmly believe that the current regulations and statutes could use some updating, but this is not the way. I would suggest industry, MnDOT, and the bill's proponent meet, as we did 10 years ago, to find some common ground and come up with a common sense approach to move us all forward. I appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to testify.
And, sir, could you repeat your name for us again and maybe spell your last name?
M-A-R-K-U-S, Howard Marcus.
Okay. All right. Very good.
And, yes, I was on the list to testify.
Yeah. Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Marcus, just a quick question. As you were starting your testimony, you really kind of talked about this being kind of a way of monitoring and regulating bills of lading and some of the things that transportation often uses. And yet in the public sector as well as the private sector, I'm not sure of any other trucking agency or trucking group that is having to commit to the same level. Why is that, or are you aware of anything else in which those that are in business transporting other products, why they don't have to do the same tariff issue?
Mr. Marcus.
Madam Chair, Representative. The reason being is that the household goods industry is a very unique industry. It's the only industry that takes your personal belongings, puts them in a truck, closes the back door, and drives away. It's not freight. It's not repetitive. This is only dealing with personal effects and belongings, your most precious possessions. This is why the consumer protection is so important to the industry. This is why there's still tariffs on the federal level also, even though they're not filed. But that's kind of the nutshell answer for you. I hope that did answer your question, sir.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Marcus, you know, I understand the need for public protection, et cetera, and yet you did mention many times that there were the federal government no longer has to file them. And so the question is being, why does the state, if we have a good working relationship with the federal government, why can't that be done the same way? And I'm not sure that I've gotten that clear answer yet from you.
Sure. Mr. Marcus?
Madam Chair, Representative, there are other consumer protection regulations on the federal level that go along with the one piece that they added to the bill, a considerable amount more. And when taken all together, that's what provides the protection, as well as the fact that Federal Motor Carrier actively goes in and investigates issues and can fine people if there is a problem. Where the state of Minnesota, it's basically educational. MnDOT doesn't go in and fine people. They go in and try to educate them to get them to do things the way they're supposed to do it.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is for the author. On 4.8 through 4.14, it talks about maintaining the records, but it doesn't say for how long, unless I'm missing that. And I know storage gets to be a major problem.
Does anybody wish to comment on that? Or? Representative Barr?
Madam Chair, Representative Mason, the term is indefinite, so whatever their latest tariff filing, that would stay in effect until the next tariff is filed.
Okay.
All right. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, regarding protecting the consumer, you know, I get the part about a mover or a carrier being bonded and insured and making sure the product gets to where it's going. But could you explain to me why posting their prices protects the consumer?
Mr. Marcus?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, I guess the easiest answer is it makes them verifiable. It prevents discrimination, prejudicial rates. It ensures that everything is fair if it's posted. When you have when you have a freight company, they have repetitive business with their customers, and their customers have the ability to, I guess you could say, punish the carrier if there's any irregularities going on. When you move, you don't move very often. It's very seldom, and there really is no protection other than being able to verify these things. Mm-hmm. And our concern is the rates wouldn't be verifiable. They could be changed at any, under the bill, they could be changed at any time, including
well,
that.
Well, thank you. Well, Madam Chair, testifier, I mean, isn't a contract a contract? I mean, isn't that between the customer and the carrier? What difference does it make if another carrier posts their prices? I mean, you can go to just about anything and shop, have a catalog, people offer things. I learned something just not too long ago. I was really surprised at, for all of us that fill up our gas tanks at the pump, there's this little internet thing where the gas retailers have to post their prices, and they can check every day what their competitor is charging. And what I learned from a lot of independents is they don't know how to manage risk in terms of last in, first out. And so the big names, the big name, I won't say names, but the big names that you frequently shop at are the ones that lead the way, and all the independents follow them. So whatever one of the big ones with those flashy signs does, the other ones follow. So they follow up. And so it's really anti-competitive. And I'm just confused. This is something I've never heard of, that you have to post your prices and your competitor can look it up to see what you're charging someone else. Really unusual.
Mr. Marcus, could I ask if a piano moving company is falling under this? Would that be the same thing? I mean, they're a one-time.
If they have house, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Mr. Marcus.
If they have household goods authority, yes. If they're moving things from one house to another, yes, they would follow under that also. Okay. It's if I might mention one other thing, if that's all right. The current system in Minnesota, we have permissive rate filing, which means that the carriers can file whatever they want. They can match their competitors and go below their competitors and go above their competitors. It doesn't make any difference. But it's public knowledge, and it's public knowledge not only for their competitors, but it's also for the public. That way the public can have a way to determine ahead of time, and that's the reason we've always had it, is for the public to be able to determine ahead of time what's it going to cost, and they can verify it.
All right. Representative Pasnik.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Marcus, how many times are there incidences where there's a complaint or something, and you said the state doesn't actually fine any of the companies, but they're trying to educate? How often is that utilized?
Mr. Marcus.
You'd have to, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative, you'd probably have to check with MnDOT about that, but I don't believe there's any. And I believe that's the reason for that is because the system's working. The existing system is working.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pasnik.
You know, I guess it's just kind of looking out at this. I don't think consumers know that this information's out there. They're not utilizing this information to pick the best prices. I don't think anybody even knows what website it is, and if you go there, probably it's very difficult to find. If they're not even educating or having any complaints, I think this is a great opportunity. Thank you, Representative Barr, for introducing this bill. It's an opportunity to reduce regulation, increase free market, and to give consumers more protection and better prices.
All right, Jenny.
If I might.
Mr. Marcus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. These rates and charges, the carrier's tariffs, are published on MnDOT's website. We worked for many years to get MnDOT to put them on the website so it would be more accessible to the public. And besides the fact that right now they're accessible through the carrier under the existing regulations, but and at MnDOT if they wanted to go down and get copies of them. MnDOT publishes a moving experience booklet, which tells people that these things are available. That we distribute, excuse me, The Minnesota Transport Services Association, myself, we distribute somewhere between 5 and 7,000 copies of the books all over the United, all over, excuse me, Minnesota, to try to educate the public as best we can. So,
Representative Kozak.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the gentleman's comments. You know, you sounds like, if I understood you correctly, your business and interest in this is that you can continue to file these tariffs and make money at that way. But I think for the typical consumer, they're not utilizing this information out there. And again, I'll reiterate my appreciation that this is a good opportunity to reduce a little bit of government.
All right. Seeing no further questions or testifiers, I'll move the House File 3282 as amended. Oh, we have to do the amendment. Okay. Yep. The DE2 amendment, all right, which is basically the bill, so which we've been discussing. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Opposed.
Yeah. Motion is approved. And now on the bill, House File 3282 as amended. Do you want some final comments, Representative Barr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Final comments would be that this is, as Representative Kozak mentioned, this is a great opportunity to eliminate some government regulation. The majority of people, when they're shopping, this is only in-state movers. So when, as example, when I made my last move, I made about 6 phone calls and did some price comparison. It was a lot easier than trying to find the tariffs on the MnDOT website. Just a few phone calls. This is what it's going to cost. They come out. They do a walkthrough. This is what we're going to charge you. Here's your price. You sign the contract, and your goods get moved. Similar to any other major purchase, you go look at a car. You go shopping for a house. You go for a freezer. You do some price comparison. You do your own shopping, and you decide where you're going to buy and who you're going to buy from. So with that, I would ask for favorable.
Once again, I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3282 as amended to Transportation Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Opposed.
Motion prevails. All right. Thank you. And the last one. I think I'm going to just sit here. I mean, it's pretty much what it how it reads. So I'll move House File 4004, and this would be referred to Transportation Finance. And the bill is just a simple clarification. Last year, there was some language in this in the House or in the final omnibus Transportation Finance bill that talked about that the state would not be contributing to the operating costs, to operating costs of light rail transit. So there were some questions about what that included. What this says is the operating costs do not include things that are more capital in nature. And maybe I'll just you can read it. So it's clear that operating costs consist of the costs associated with light rail system daily operations and the maintenance costs associated with keeping light rail services and facilities operating, but they do not include costs to incur or expand the existing system, construct new buildings or facilities, purchase new vehicles, or make technology improvements. So it's trying to just separate very clearly what is a capital investment from an operating investment. So would there be anyone interested in testifying? This can be the only reason that Mr. Shetland is still here. So. We haven't heard from you today.
Great. So. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Yep, I'm Judd Shetland with the Met Council. Nice to see everyone again. I think it's this is an interesting bill. I just want to make sure that one of the things that was mentioned, that this is a simple clarification. The bill does go beyond what the agreement was in last year's transportation bill. That bill dealt with clarifying that the 50% state share of the Southwest line was going to be funded by the counties, and this goes further than that. So I just want to make sure that the committee is aware of that. One of the other things that I wanted to point out, and this is what is
concerning, at least to the Met Council, Metro Transit, is that on lines, it is on lines 1.20 and 1.21, that says operating costs do not include costs incurred to enhance or expand the existing system. And the way that we interpret this is when this bill, if it were ever to be signed into law, the day that that bill was, that law was created, then you are establishing what the existing system is, and that we would not, that operating costs would not allow to enhance or expand the existing system that would be in effect the day that the bill passed. And so I want you to think about, like, we just had the Super Bowl in town, and we were running additional service when the Super Bowl was here because there was the demand for this, and it was one of the requirements is that we had good transit service for that event. And I would just let the committee know that next year the region is hosting the Final Four. And the way that this bill reads, when you say to enhance or expand the existing system, we would be in a position where we wouldn't be able to provide that. And also, I know you've heard from me in this committee and probably other committees that we expect that the region is going to grow quite a bit and that there may be a need to add another a train or to increase our headways from 7 minutes to 6 minutes during over the period of time. And so I would just appeal to you to really potentially reconsider that language as part of this bill, because you are really locking us in at that point. And I'm not sure that that was the intention that you had, Madam Chair, but if that's the case, I would really like to have the committee potentially reconsider that language. And I also just wanted to make sure that folks were aware that the transportation bill last year, that language applied to Southwest, and this going forward changes it for not just Southwest but for other lines. So with that, that's all I have. But it was that we were the last ones here tonight, so it was.
Thank you, Mr. Shetland. Representative Horstein.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
We didn't switch spots.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess in addition to the issues that Mr. Shetland raised, I would have, and maybe this is for the author, I've had some ongoing concerns about safety issues in the Kenilworth corridor, for example, but along any of these corridors and co-location, et cetera. And, you know, we have obviously, you know, into the future, maybe there'll be some version of positive train control that the Met Council may want to adopt or other safety measures. Would a safety measure also be considered an enhancement?
Representative Rumbach?
Well, I mean, I'm sure it depends on how it's defined, you know. So we may want to make some clarifications in this area. That certainly seems like one way, enhancement, probably, mm-hmm. that, you know, we wouldn't want to preclude right. for certain. But I wondered if maybe, Mr. Shetland, could you mentioned the Super Bowl. What sorts of things in that service, you know, were expanded or enhanced to accommodate the Super Bowl?
Madam Chair and members, as you know, during the Super Bowl, we made a change to our service where we were running buses out of the Mall of America on that line that were then going around the U.S. Bank Stadium while we were just running trains directly into downtown. The reason why we did that is we had folks who were going through the security at the Mall of America station who were then able to go directly to the Super Bowl station where they'd already been through the security at that point, so there wasn't a giant backlog of security measures that had to be taken at that at the U.S. Bank Stadium piece. And so we made some adjustments to our service in order to accommodate that. We also made adjustments on the Green Line in the east side, I think it was around the Fairview station, that were then taking the trains to the U.S. Bank Stadium as well and running the bus service around there. And we thought we had a very flawless type of plan that we put into effect. And I'm just telling you that the way that the bill reads today and knowing what the expectations are going to be related to the Final Four and other types of events that we're going to have in the region, that it's going to be really important for us to have some flexibility when it comes to that. And I don't think House File 4004 allows that.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shetland, and committee, those, as you've described them, sound like operating costs to me. But it, you know, it may bear, it bears some clarification. And so I'd be happy to put in some language and work with you to make certain that it's, you know, clearly capital, sort of the major expenditures, construction, that sort of thing.
And Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair,
Mr. Shannon,
and Representative Runbeck, I would say the best way to do that would be to delete the operating costs. I would, that just says to enhance or expand the existing system, because that is really where we are being tied down. The rest of the piece, the construct new buildings or facilities, purchase new vehicles, or make technology improvements, those are capital in nature. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that that language is there, we don't have a problem with that because we consider those a capital cost as well.
And, I know where we're at on that, that little area. So I think, though, it would bear a little bit more consideration. And so I'd like to, you know, work with Mr. Burris and research to just make certain we have the right verbiage in this case.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I would say that we would probably oppose any language change that would not allow us to enhance or expand the existing system that relates to operating cost. So the best.
Oh, exactly.
Okay.
Sure.
So noted. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shenton. I just want to make sure I clarify. So this additional busing that you did, you're including that as part of the light rail enhancement, you know, because it was kind of at the light rail system, or is this separate?
Madam Chair, Representative Petersburg, we were running additional train service at that point to run the folks from the Mall of America down to the U.S. Bank Stadium. So if you read the bill and take it in a literal sense, that would be considered an expansion of operating by running those additional trains and running the buses were just an example of what we did related to the Super Bowl experience, but we were actually running additional trains as well, and so they would be prohibited under this language if you take it literally, because we don't run that service regularly. We did it because there was a special event.
Representative Petersburg, follow up.
Thank you. I think that clarifies. When you used the example of the buses in regards to a light rail operating cost, that confused me a little bit as to you, were you trying to imply one versus another, which this bill obviously doesn't talk about busing. So thank you for the clarification.
Representative Yochim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Runbeck. I share some of the same concerns that Mr. Shetman brought up, and Mr. Shetman, too, when it comes to expand the existing system or enhance, even during, let's say, a Vikings game or Minnesota United game when it's at U.S. Bank Stadium, if I can remember right, you've run extra trains during then, right?
Mr. Shetman?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Mr. Chair and Representative Yochim, that is correct. So the trick that we have here with this language is when the language goes into effect, you're basically stamping what the existing service is. And so I don't know how much flexibility what we have there, but I don't think that it's up for us to determine what it is. We're basing it off what the language says. And so we do add additional trains when there are Vikings games, or if there's, I mean, for instance, last year we had a Saints game, we had a University of Minnesota football game, a Vikings preseason game, and a Twins game all on the same day. So we were running all kinds of service that day, and that is not a typical service day. And so it gets into the question about what is considered to enhance or expand the existing system when that is put into effect.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I mean, so I'm hearing what you're saying, and I think, yes, it needs clarifying. So, but what I would like to do is move it, and we will make the appropriate amendments.
Okay. Representative Yochim has an amendment. Seeing no other questions, if you want to offer your amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Runbeck, I hope you'll consider this because we could take care of this right now in committee tonight so that there is no confusion. And my amendment simply after on line 1.20 after the period strikes the second sentence. So it would still be able to give the flexibility Met Council needs to do the job they're doing now and I would hope the committee would consider it.
Representative Rumba?
So, Representative Ibo-Akim, there is something called capital maintenance, and so I think, you know, there are certain pots and certain categories, you know, within the maintenance area, maintenance repair, capital maintenance, capital repair. I mean, I would prefer to consult with Mr. Burris and make sure that we get it exactly as it should be. So at this point, I would rather, you know, I would not support the amendment, but we will work on it. I assure you that.
Representative Yochim?
Mr. Chair, Chair Runbeck, I understand that, but we're talking about operating costs, not capital. So I can see what you're trying to do with the bill, and I'm sorry.
In a backwards way,
Madam. Can I finish my sentence, please?
Sorry,
thank
go ahead.
It really does start feeling like a death by a thousand cuts when it comes to expanding any of our existing standard systems that are in a fixed mode. And this basically would say when they report to the feds to try to get the money, they can't consider any of their operating costs. So while I appreciate the fact that you're willing to work with the Met Council, I think it would be better to have that discussion out in the open right now. And I would like a vote on the amendment, if possible.
Okay. We probably technically have to move the amendment. I don't think we've actually done that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So if you want to do that, and then we'll continue the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Amendment 18-5240. Oh, no, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong thing. I would like to move the A18 Amendment 0634.
Okay. The amendment has been moved. Any further discussion, Representative Runbeck?
Mr. Chair and members, I mean, I understand what is being said. This is sort of a backwards way of saying and clarifying what is the capital cost. I just want to make sure and work on an amendment that might get a little closer to making certain that there's some categories that should be included that we don't want to just leave off. So I would prefer a no vote.
Madam Chair, point of order.
Mr. Representative Herpas?
Representative Yochim, you referred to the amendment as 18-5240. Isn't that just the drafting number of the bill?
Representative Hertas, she corrected herself, and A18063 is the amendment.
Okay.
Down below in the amendment, I see where the other number is.
Yeah. Right. Sorry, Mr. Chair, and sorry, Representative Hertas, I should not try to write and speak at the same time. It obviously does not work very well. So, yes, I was moving the A18 amendment.
Well, thank you, Representative Yochim and Mr. Chair. As you know, we all make mistakes sometimes.
Any other member discussion? All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed, say same sign.
Aye.
Aye.
Motion does not pass. Representative Rumbeck, do you want to renew your motion, or I'll renew your motion to re-refer House File 4004 to the House Transportation Finance Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
Motion passes.
All right. We